This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a lot of reasons to worry about the American economy, and most Americans are worried about their personal finances. To get a grip on Barack Obama and John McCain's plans for taxes and the economy, we're going to talk with the top economic advisor from each campaign and the director for the Tax Policy Center, which provides independent analysis of tax issues. Let's start with John McCain's senior advisor for economic policy, Douglas Holtz Aiken. He directed the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 2005 under President Bush. That's the office that prices proposed legislation and analyzes its economic impact. Holtz Aiken resigned a year before his four-year term was up and went to the Council on Foreign Relations. Douglas Holtz Aiken, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, correct me if I mischaracterize this, but as the Congressional Budget Office director, you took issue with President Bush cutting taxes while raising spending, and you said no way the math was going to work out on that. John McCain wants to keep the president's tax cuts and extend them. Why?
Because he understands that at this point in time, the most important way to evaluate any policy is through the lens of creating jobs. Even though we've lost 400,000 jobs, over 400,000 in the past 6 months in the United States, we've seen over that period small businesses, those under 50 employees, actually create nearly a quarter of a million jobs. So step number one is do no harm to the small business sector, much of which is taxed through the individual income tax. So don't raise taxes, don't raise the marginal tax rates on those individuals, don't raise dividend and capital gains taxes when they're going to need equity investments in a world where debt is going to be hard to get a handle on because of the credit crunch. And we've got the second highest corporate rate in the developed world. The combination of that rate and some other features are driving good jobs, the kinds that have health insurance and retirement benefits overseas. He wants to keep those jobs in America. So the proposals are oriented around the very first step to being successful over the long term, which is have an economy that's growing, creating jobs. Those jobs will be the foundation of all the prosperity that Americans hope for. They're also the foundation for a better fiscal outlook.
Let me read a criticism of the McCain tax plan from the Tax Policy Center, which is a program at the Brookings Institution. The McCain tax plan would make the tax system more regressive, even compared with a system in which the 2001 to 2006 tax cuts are made permanent, because it would give huge tax cuts to households at the very top of the income distribution, but little tax relief to those at the bottom of the income scale. Your response?
This reveals all that is wrong with budgeting in Washington, D.C., and why this city needs a vast cleanup effort. John McCain's tax proposals are very simple. Under the present system, the top marginal tax rate is 35%. Under John McCain, 35%. Current dividends top rate, 15%. John McCain, 15%. Current capital gains rate, 15%. John McCain's, 15%. No tax cuts there anywhere. John McCain does want to cut the corporate tax rate. Now, in a Tax Policy Center view of the universe, that benefit goes to some fat cat who never had to worry about losing their job. But out in the real world, what's happening is people are not keeping their jobs. Those jobs are being moved to other parts of the globe, and the burden of that tax is being borne by workers. That tax cut will benefit those people by keeping their jobs here, keeping their benefits intact, and helping the economy grow.
Senator McCain thinks that we should not have a timetable for withdrawal in Iraq and that we'll have to remain there. Our troops will have to remain there for an extended time. How do expenses for the war get figured into his proposed budget?
Our proposals are built off the CBO baseline projections and augmented to reflect the current deployments overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. It is the senator's views that having devised the counterinsurgency strategy, the surge that is working, and that will allow the United States to leave in victory as opposed to a hasty withdrawal that would require a third Iraq war, we can achieve savings by 2013. It would be his hope that we'd have about 75,000, half the number now, stationed overseas, or even do better than that. That'll reduce federal spending in the defense area, and that would be a very beneficial thing from a budgetary point of view.
Former Senator Phil Graham, who was the former chair of the Senate Finance Committee, stepped down last week as co-campaign manager of the McCain campaign after his comments that Americans are experiencing a mental recession and that we're a nation of whiners. Until he resigned, he'd played a major role in crafting McCain's economic policies, and he was being mentioned as a possible Treasury Secretary if McCain wins. Is he still informally advising John McCain? And is he still a possibility for Treasury Secretary?
He is not advising the campaign. He is not affiliated in any way. He properly made the decision to step down after remarks that were unfortunate and completely at odds with the senator's view of what is going on in the economy and how the American public is viewing their situation. So he is not affiliated with the campaign. And obviously, it is premature to discuss appointments of any kind, whether they be Treasury or other possible agency appointments in a McCain administration.
So you're not ruling it out?
I am not ruling it out. I'm not ruling it – well, I guess I am ruling it out. I don't know what the decisions are that are going to be made on staffing, but it's premature to discuss names.
No, Graham was criticized for his recent comments, but let's talk about the policy that he stood for. In 2000, he co-sponsored a bill called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that deregulated the banking industry, making it possible for commercial banks, investment banks, and insurance companies to merge. This bill also deregulated some of the complicated financial instruments that are behind the mortgage meltdown and the financial crisis, like credit default swaps. And it enabled losses, certain losses, to be kept off the books through complicated things called structured investment vehicles. The bill also prevented the regulation of energy futures, and that part of the bill became known as the Enron loophole. It's been blamed for the California energy crisis a few years ago and subsequently for the whole Enron collapse. But this whole bill that Graham co-sponsored was added as a rider right before the Christmas recess to a big omnibus spending bill. And a lot of people think that most of the senators who voted on it didn't really understand it or didn't really know what was in it. So since Graham was so highly placed in the McCain campaign, do his views on deregulation reflect John McCain's views?
And well, obviously not. I mean, Senator McCain has, first of all, been a longstanding critic of that style of doing business, large omnibus spending bills that aren't scrutinized, provisions dropped into bills in the dead of the night without proper vetting. His view of the way that Congress should work is defend a proposal on its merits in the House, defend it in the Senate, agree on it in a conference, have it passed by both houses and signed by the President of the United States. And to do things in any other way is to really betray the trust of the American public. He has voted to close the Enron loophole in 2003. The senator's economic views are his own. He has lots of advisors, whether it be Jack Kemp, Steve Forbes, Martin Feldstein, John Taylor. There are an enormous number of people with whom he converses. He's fond of getting direct input from experts and is perfectly content to make up his own mind about the best path forward.
And the deregulation of the banking industry? I mean, right now the government policy seems to be that there are some banks and institutions, including Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that are just too big to fail, that the consequences would be cataclysmic for America and the global economy as well. So some economists say we've kind of done this backwards. For instance, the bill that Phil Graham co-sponsored, we deregulated part of the financial industry because the government was said to have no place there. But then when the big banks are in trouble, that's when the government has to step in and help them out.
We've seen two particular instances in the United States recently. One, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, literally a tribute to Washington and the worst aspects of Washington. This is a lobbyist-driven operation that showered favors across the board to make sure that they could continue to expand at the taxpayers' expense. In the private sector, we saw the Fed make the decision in the Bear Stearns case. They were privy to the details that others are not, but presumably the tenet that guided that decision was, is it worse to leave the situation alone and allow the financial system as a whole to be threatened and the stability of that system thus threaten all of Main Street and American families, or is it better to provide the steps that they did and allow the precedent of shoring up a private institution? The senator is certainly not happy with the idea that the taxpayers are backing private institutions, but it's important to make sure that we don't further hurt the public by not stepping in at the right moment.
John McCain has said that the economy is not his strong point, that he doesn't know that much about the economy. Is that a fatal flaw for a president? Does it matter?
He has a phenomenal grasp of the economy, and the remark he made is self-deprecating. That's John McCain in his truest form. But he is comparing himself to a standard of excellence on international affairs and national security that no one could meet. He's the preeminent expert in those areas. He's been chair of the Commerce Committee. He's a superb policymaker in economics, and the U.S. economy is in good hands with John McCain.
This is not a direct campaign question, but while you're here, I'd like to know your impression of how far away is our economy from hitting bottom? How close are we to hitting bottom so we could start going back up again?
It's hard to say. The basic contours of the economic outlook right now are that if you make something in America, if you produce and sell a product or service, you're hanging in there. It's not great. And outside of the housing sector, you know, we have strong exports. We have some places where things are going okay, but they're hanging in there. If you finance something in America, you're in a world of hurt. The financial sector is clearly a battleground. And the real question is, can the Main Street folks hang in there until the financial sector gets its house in order, or will the credit crunch and the restrictions on lending bleed over into Main Street and further depress the economy? That's one that I don't think the science allows us to answer. It's one that we monitor every day. It's clearly a concern about the outlook. There's nothing that looks like strong growth in the near term, and the question is whether we can go through with something that looks like moderate growth over the second half.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, thank you very much for talking with us.
Great, thank you.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken is the top economic advisor for John McCain. We just heard from John McCain's chief economic advisor. My next guest is Barack Obama's economic policy director, Jason Furman. Before that, he directed the Hamilton Project at the Brookings Institution, which focused on economic policy, and he was special assistant to the president for economic policy in the Clinton administration. Jason Furman, welcome to Fresh Air. The government helped bail out Bear Stearns, extending the lower interest rates to investment banks to help them through this crisis. The government is likely to, in one way or another, bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac because of the mortgage crisis. These are institutions that are considered too big to fail. What does Barack Obama have to say about what the government role should be in bailing out such institutions, and if there should be more regulation of these institutions in return for the help the government is giving?
Well, first, Terry, Barack Obama thinks we should also be worried about people that are too little to fail. If you're a homeowner and you've been foreclosed upon, that's enormously difficult for you. It's happening to 7,000 homeowners every day, and it has repercussions beyond that individual family to the whole community and the national economy, and hurts all of us, whether or not we're directly affected or not. Then when you look at the financial sector, we're going to need to make some major regulatory changes going forward to reflect the increased complexity of these institutions, the fact that many more institutions have access to federal borrowing than had them in the past. That's a real privilege. But in exchange for that privilege, we need to know what those institutions are doing, and we need to place some limits on what those institutions can do when they take gambles that heads they win, tails the taxpayer loses.
So with the tax system the way Obama would like to see it, would we be getting more or less money from taxes in the long run?
The Obama plan includes a very large tax cut for middle-class families. High-income families making above $250,000 a year would be paying more in taxes. When you take the plan as a whole and include the tax credits to help make health care more affordable, because the whole Obama health plan is centered around tax credits, it would actually reduce taxes relative to where they are today, and that would be paid for by a set of spending reductions.
What programs would you cut or reduce?
Well, the biggest one is ending the war in Iraq responsibly. We're spending $10 billion a month, even budgeting very conservatively. That's an area where we could save $90 billion a year by 2012, probably more than that. And that's money we could put towards better uses for our national security, as well as towards this overall economic plan. In addition, there's several other areas. For example, private plans within Medicare get really large subsidies right now. We should move those subsidies down so that they're competing on a level playing field with the public plans. Same things with banks that make student loans. They get over-subsidized. We can reform our farm payments to some of our wealthiest farmers, cut back on earmarks, reform procurement, and no-bid contracts. There's quite a lot we can do on the spending side.
Barack Obama has said that Afghanistan is where he'd really like to focus his attention on the war on terror. So if we get troops out of Iraq, won't some of those troops have to go to Afghanistan, and won't that offset some of the savings from the war in Iraq if the plan proceeds that way?
Terry, you're absolutely right. The conservative set of savings, the $90 billion a year that we project we save on Iraq, most of that money actually goes back to our national security. It goes to transfer troops to Afghanistan. It goes to increasing the size of our standing army with more special forces, Army and Marines, some of the areas where we're short right now. And it also goes to something that's just as important to our national security, which is foreign assistance to win the hearts and minds of countries around the world. So a lot of that money is about taking the money we save from ending the war responsibly in Iraq and using that money in a way that will better promote our national security and deal with some of the areas that we've seriously been neglecting over the last 8 years.
How does Senator Obama propose fixing Social Security now that the baby boom is starting to collect, keeping Social Security solvent?
What Senator Obama has said is three things. Number one, this is our most important public program. It's really important that we protect it, not just for people today, but for generations to come. Second of all, middle-class families, a lot of them, it's their only source of income or the overwhelming source of their income. So it's really not something you would want to burden them with in the course of adjusting to that. So what he's said is we should look at people making over $250,000 a year and ask them to pay a bit more, and that money would go into Social Security. In terms of exactly how much more, that's something he would want to work with Congress on a bipartisan basis to get it done to strengthen the program.
Senator Obama has said he would bring down health insurance premiums by $2,500 for the typical family, and that his plan would be in place by the end of his first term as president. How would he accomplish that?
There are a lot of different causes of rising health costs, and to bring them down, you want to do a whole bunch of different steps at once. Some of those steps involve taking on some of the insurance companies which are responsible for some of these costs. So reducing the overpayments to private plans and Medicare, which we were discussing earlier. And if you just tell insurance companies you have to cover everyone who shows up, you save a lot of money that they're currently spending deciding who they'll cover, who they won't cover, and what they won't pay for. So that set of reforms will save money.
Can I just stop you for a second? I'm sure a lot of health insurance companies would say that the bureaucratic part of deciding whether I'm worthy of an MRI or a CAT scan might be cheaper than actually giving me that CAT scan if they decided I didn't really need it, because there's so many really, really expensive procedures now.
Well, first of all, part of what I was talking about was deciding whether or not when you show up, they're going to give you health insurance or not. That's something that insurance companies spend money on. Under the Obama plan, they'd be required to offer you health insurance.
Okay.
So that you'd save. There would obviously still be claims management. You'd have to decide what you would honor and what you wouldn't, and there would be administrative costs in the health insurance system. The question is, can you bring them down, and can you bring down some of those administrative costs that are spent on things that take away from health and hurt the system? But obviously, we would still need some of the other ones.
I asked John McCain's campaign advisor if it concerned him that John McCain had confessed that the economy wasn't his strong point. Let me ask you, Barack Obama is, you know, relatively new to national politics. Are you concerned that his experience with national economic issues has been very limited?
I'm not concerned about that at all, Terry. I can tell you, I talked to Barack Obama a lot about economic policy, and if he had more time, he could do my job far better than I can do my own job. He really understands the economy. He's really interested in it. He's worked significantly on the issue in the Senate. It's something he's written extensively about in his book. I have absolute faith that he would be outstanding on the economy.
This isn't a direct policy question, but since you know a lot about the economy, I would just like to ask your opinion. How far do you think we are from actually financially hitting bottom? How far away from are we from beginning to, like, go back up again economically?
Well, Terry, I think forecasting an economy, especially one as uncertain as this, is a fool's game. The credit strains we have, though, are ones that will take a long amount of time to work out, and they'll have ramifications for investment and economic activity for a long time to come. What is important to understand, though, is that the choices we make today really could have an impact on the direction that the economy goes over the near term. We're in better shape today because of the fiscal stimulus we passed back in February. We'd be in better shape still if we move vigorously to address the problems in housing, to help relieve families from some of these energy prices, to deal with the contractions at the state level, and to really focus on job creation. So there's a lot we can do that really affects the answer to your question of where the economy is going.
Well, Jason Furman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jason Furman is Barack Obama's top economic advisor. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After hearing from the top economic advisors to the McCain and Obama campaigns, we wanted an independent point of view on their tax plans. My guest, Leonard Berman, is the director of the Tax Policy Center, which is a joint project of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. Yesterday, the center updated its analysis of the McCain and Obama tax plans. Berman served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Analysis at the Treasury from 1998 to 2000 and as Senior Analyst at the Congressional Budget Office from 1988 to 97. Leonard Berman, welcome to Fresh Air. In the report, you write, no one, not even inside the campaigns, knows exactly what the proposals are. What do you mean by that?
Well, the kinds of things you say on the stump and that generate huge applause lines don't actually make legislative proposals. We're going to provide universal health care coverage. We're going to exempt old people from tax. There are a lot of details that matter in terms of how you estimate these things. Like in the health proposals, it really depends very critically on what you're going to do with the non-group market, the place where people buy health insurance who don't get it at work. A lot of those details aren't specified. The actual subsidy schedule, the Senator Obama is interested in making it very affordable for low-income people to get health insurance. But as far as I can tell, his campaign hasn't specified what subsidy you get at what income levels.
President Bush's tax cuts expire in 2010. So that means that the next president will have a lot of sway in deciding who pays what taxes, how much they pay. So in the Obama plan and in the McCain plan, how is the tax burden distributed compared to how it's distributed now?
Okay, so Senator McCain would basically extend all of President Bush's tax cuts, and he also has other cuts for businesses. And instead of eliminating the estate tax, he would cut it somewhat. Senator Obama would extend most of the Bush tax cuts that would otherwise expire at the end of 2010, but he'd raise taxes on high-income people, or return the levels of tax to what they were before 2001, and he has a bunch of tax cuts targeted at low- and middle-income people. So, for example, the middle 20%, say middle-class taxpayers, under Senator McCain, they'd get a $1,400 tax cut. Under Senator Obama, they'd get a $2,100 tax cut in 2012. The bottom 20%, these are pretty low-income people making less than about $19,000 a year, they get an average tax cut of about $100 under Senator McCain's plan and almost $700 under Senator Obama's plan. So there's a big change in the tilt in the tax schedule. There's a big cut at the bottom for Obama and a big increase at the top. And under McCain, there's a tiny cut at the bottom and huge cuts at the top.
When you look at the bottom line of each of those plans, do they generate an equal amount of money in taxes?
No. Senator Obama's plan would add up to about $2.8 trillion in tax cuts over the next 10 years. Senator McCain's plan would add up to about $4.2 trillion in tax cuts. When you add the interest that would accrue, we're talking about an increase in the national debt of about $5 trillion under Senator McCain's plan and $3.4 trillion under Senator Obama's. I should point out that the candidates object to my saying that, but they say, well, they both say they're going to cut spending. And if they do, then the situation would be better. They won't be generating such large deficits. There, a lot of people are skeptical about their claims of spending cuts, but all of our numbers are just looking at the tax side.
So you're not looking at the spending side. You can't pass judgment on that.
Not as an expert. As a casual consumer, I can be skeptical.
Now, there's something called the alternative minimum tax, which was meant to be a tax for the wealthy, but it was never adjusted for cost of living, and it now raises the taxes for many middle-class people. How do Obama and McCain plan to deal with the alternative minimum tax?
That's actually one area where there's some confusion. Senator Obama actually hasn't said much about the AMT. What we decided was that we would model his plan as if it would just be a continuation of what's been happening over the last 4 or 5 years. Congress has patched the AMT, which means they raise the exempt amount of income, the minimum income level at which the AMT might kick in every year to keep millions and millions of Americans from being subject to the tax. And we assume that Senator Obama would just continue to enact this patch, increase it for inflation every year so that the number of people on the AMT wouldn't increase too much. But he's never been specific about that. The campaign doesn't object to our characterizing their plan that way. Senator McCain's staff has been very specific. Doug Holtz-Aiken, who you've talked to, says that what they're going to do is also extend this AMT patch, but they're also going to increase that over time so that the number of people on the AMT will drop. But Senator McCain has continually talked about repealing the AMT, eliminating it altogether, and which they do matters, because if you repeal the AMT, that's another $400 billion in lost tax revenues. But we're not entirely clear on what happens.
Let's talk about capital gains. Taxes on earnings in stocks are 15%. And if you're in a high tax bracket, if you make a lot of money and you're a high tax bracket, that 15% tax on capital gains is considerably lower than what you would pay on income earned through a job. So what does each campaign plan to do about capital gains?
Well, Senator McCain would just leave the rate at 15% for capital gains and for dividends, the money that's paid to shareholders from companies. Senator Obama would raise the capital gains rate to 25% or so. Again, there's a little squishiness on what the actual number is. And leave it there permanently. I actually wrote a book about capital gains taxation. It's been a huge bestseller. That was a little joke. I wrote a book about capital gains called The Labyrinth of Capital Gains Tax Policy. And it's a pretty fascinating issue, actually, because it's kind of a religious crusade. There are some people who believe that cutting capital gains tax rates is absolutely essential to encouraging investment and producing economic growth. There are others who believe that low capital gains tax rate is just inherently evil because the benefits almost all accrue to very high-income people. And my view is kind of in the middle, that cutting the capital gains tax rate produces some good outcomes and some bad ones. It does encourage some more investment than would occur otherwise. One of the bad things about taxing capital gains is it gives people an incentive to hold on to things longer than they would otherwise. But the bad thing about the low capital gains tax rate is that it produces a huge incentive to try to make other income look like capital gains. If you're a high-income person and you earn $1 million as regular income, it's taxed at a 35% rate. If you can make that look like a capital gain, it's taxed at a 15% rate, and you save $200,000 in taxes. And there's a whole industry that's devoted to coming up with clever ways to make that $1 million look like capital gain rather than ordinary income. And that's very wasteful. First of all, the geniuses who come up with the schemes to make income look like capital gains could otherwise be doing socially productive things like working in think tanks or working on radio stations, or maybe even figuring out a way to make a car that somebody would want to buy somewhere else. And they're not doing that. They're just coming up with these tax shelters. But the other thing is the tax shelters themselves often involve really dubious investments.
Let's look at the estate tax and opponents of the estate tax, people who want to eliminate it or, you know, reduce it to a very minimal amount, often describe it as the death tax. Where does each campaign stand on the estate tax? And why is that important in the overall vision of the tax plan?
Neither one of them would eliminate the estate tax altogether. Right now, the schedule is that in 2010, the estate tax is supposed to disappear altogether, and then in 2011, return again, which has produced a lot of ghoulish humor about, economic incentives at the end of 2010 if you have a rich relative that might productively die and save you a lot of tax liability on the estate. Senator McCain actually has been a longstanding critic of eliminating the estate tax. He's always voted against it. And his plan would keep the estate tax, but at a very low level. It wouldn't apply until you had an estate of $5 million. We estimate that about only 4,000 decedents would be subject to that tax in 2009, and the rate would be 15%, the same as applies to capital gains. Senator Obama would set the level at what it's supposed to be in 2009, which is a $3.5 million exemption and 45% tax rate. So for couples, that would correspond to with some planning, a $7 million exemption in the case of Obama and a $10 million exemption in the case of McCain. I think the estate tax is actually an important part of the overall tax system. First of all, it's the most progressive tax that there is. It only applies to very, very wealthy individuals, and it only applies after they're dead when they don't need the money anymore. The other thing is that it reduces the incentive to engage in tax shelters because it's sort of like it's a backstop to the income tax, that if you manage to avoid tax all through your life, you're still going to have to pay it under the estate tax. And by really cutting it back dramatically or eliminating it altogether, you could encourage a lot of inefficient tax sheltering activity. So I think preserving the tax at some level is a good idea.
Let's get back to our interview about the Obama and McCain tax plans. My guest, Leonard Berman, is the director of the Tax Policy Center. The Tax Policy Center's new report on the economic programs of McCain and Obama includes a preliminary analysis of their health care plans. So why don't you tell us what you think the centerpiece of each of their plans is?
The plans are pretty interesting. One thing that Senator McCain and Senator Obama agree on is that the tax subsidies for health care should be targeted more at low and middle-income people than what they are right now. The current system we have is that there's a huge tax subsidy for getting health insurance, but it's in the form of an exclusion from income. If your employer provides you health insurance, the value of the insurance isn't included in your taxable income. You save income taxes and Social Security and Medicare taxes, too. That's worth the most to pretty high-income people. The higher your tax bracket is, the more benefit you get. And it's really, in a lot of ways, an upside-down subsidy. The people who most need help get next to nothing from the current system. So Senator McCain would replace the income tax exclusion with a tax credit of $2,500 for a single policy or $5,000 for family coverage, and it would be refundable, meaning that you'd get the tax credit even if you didn't have any tax liability. So under that proposal, low-income people would get a substantial benefit if they got insurance either at work or bought it themselves. Another change in this proposal is that you get the subsidy even if your employer doesn't offer insurance. A lot of people complain that the credits are too small for lower-income people to be able to afford insurance, but this would be a big improvement over current law. The other thing that it would do, which would be an improvement, is that the credit doesn't depend on how much you spend on insurance, so you'd have an incentive to get relatively inexpensive insurance. The reason that's important is that there are a lot of people who think that very, very generous insurance coverage encourages people to spend too much on health care because it doesn't cost them anything. Everything's covered by insurance. And the idea is that by having a credit that's fixed in dollar terms, you'd have an incentive to shop around for a cheap policy. The drawback of the McCain proposal is that a lot of people would probably end up in this individual market that, a lot of employers would probably say, I don't have to offer insurance anymore for my employees to get a tax break. They can buy it themselves. If you're young and healthy, you'll be able to get a really good deal on insurance. But if you have serious health problems, you might have a hard time finding affordable insurance. Senator McCain has a proposal to cover people with serious health problems, but there are no specifics on how that works. And our analysis suggested that if that high-risk pool is not very comprehensive, that Senator McCain's proposal would not actually end up covering that many more people. There'd be a lot of people who would get insurance in the individual non-group market, but a lot of people would end up losing coverage through employers.
What's the centerpiece of Senator Obama's health care plan?
Senator Obama is also proposing refundable tax credits that would benefit low and middle-income households who get insurance in a new health insurance exchange that he would create. It would be a pool of insurance plans that would be available to anybody who buys insurance using these tax credits. The credits would be available to people with incomes up to about four times the poverty level. That's roughly $80,000 for a family of four. There'd be very large subsidies for low-income people, people below the poverty line, and then they would decline as income increased. Senator Obama also has a mandate for covering children. You'd be required by law to cover your children with health insurance. He would expand a public program that provides insurance for children called SCHIP, State Children's Health Insurance Program, for families with incomes up to three times poverty. He would expand the Medicaid program for very low-income people. And he'd also put in place a mandate on employers to provide insurance. It's this thing that health geeks call pay or play. And the way it would work is that if an employer did not provide insurance, they'd have to pay a payroll tax. We assumed it would be about 6%, but again, there are no details on this from the campaign. And under the assumptions of our analysis, this plan would cover virtually all kids and many adults, although it wouldn't come close to reaching universal coverage. There'd still be about 30 million adults in the year 2018 that didn't have health insurance coverage. I should mention, and this is important, in our analysis of both of these plans, that there are important details that we didn't know about, that we didn't get from the campaigns, and we just made stuff up so we could do the analysis. I'm sure the campaigns would say, well, the actual plan is a lot better in several respects from what you modeled. A problem, of course, is that a lot of ways you could make these plans better to cover more people would also cost more money. Our estimate is that Senator McCain's plan would add another, you know, would add up to about $1.3 trillion over the next 10 years. Senator Obama's plan would add up to about $1.6 trillion. And that's a lot of money, especially when you consider that they're, you know, spending, they've got $3 or $4 trillion in tax cuts already for the rest of their package.
So it sounds like in the Obama plan, and tell me if I understand this correctly, if an employer decides not to pay for health insurance for its employees, it would then have to pay a separate tax that would be put into the kind of the common pot for funding health insurance.
Yeah. And as I said, the details aren't exactly clear, but we assumed it would be a 6% tax. So if somebody was making $50,000 and the employer didn't provide insurance, the employer would have to pay $3,000 in taxes into this pool, and that would go to reduce the overall cost of the package or allow for larger subsidies for people to get their insurance outside of work. Also, Senator Obama has said that his pay-or-play plan would exempt small employers. The definition of small is not entirely clear. We assumed it was employers with fewer than 10 employees.
Overall, looking at the entire tax and economic plan that you've examined so far, what would you say is the greatest strength of each plan?
Senator McCain obviously intends to spur economic growth. Probably the best feature of his plan is cutting the corporate tax rate. We have the second highest tax rate in the developed world at 35%, and that probably encourages a lot of bad behavior and, you know, trying to keep income overseas so that it's not subject to U.S. tax, and it encourages a lot of tax sheltering by companies. And even though we have a very high tax rate, we don't collect very much revenue from the corporate tax because of all the tax sheltering that goes on. My preference would have been for the plan to include many more loophole closers at the same time that the rate was cut, but I think it's a good idea to cut the corporate tax rate. One of the big issues over the last couple decades is that high-income people have been taking home almost all of the economic gains that we've gotten. The economy has been growing dramatically, but most of those gains have been going to the people at the very, very top. By one measure, the richest 1% of Americans have now earned something like 16% of the overall income in the United States, and that's the highest level since the eve of the Great Depression. So it really is a legitimate issue to talk about whether we should be doing something to share the economic gains more equally. One of the points that Senator Obama makes is that at the same time that the income distribution has been getting more and more skewed, that high-income people have been taking home a larger and larger share of national income, that we've been cutting taxes on those very high-income people and not doing very much for people in the middle. And his proposals are aimed at providing help for low- and middle-income people so they can share more of the economic gains.
What do you think is one of the greatest weaknesses of the Obama and the McCain plans?
Well, and one obvious criticism is that they both would increase the deficit by a lot. Will Rogers once said that when you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you should do is stop digging. And they both would dig the hole a lot deeper. Just the non-health parts of the plans would add between $3.5 and $5 trillion to the national debt over the next 10 years. And you say, well, maybe that's not a big deal. We're a rich country. But we're actually heading into what's going to be a really challenging period for us because the baby boomers are starting to retire. They're going to put unprecedented demands on the government. And we're going to need more revenues, not less. We also need to figure out what to do about Medicare and Social Security, which so far nobody's been able to do. The best thing we could do for our kids, if we can't fix Social Security and Medicare, would be at least not to saddle them with a huge amount of additional debt, so that they would, they won't have to pay back our borrowing with interest at the same time as they're paying for our Medicare and Social Security. I worry in Senator Obama's plan that he's got all these special targeted breaks. He's got one provision that would exempt senior citizens earning under $50,000 from income tax. Well, right now, most senior citizens don't pay tax. The ones who are making $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 are doing relatively well. They have income from pensions and other assets that make them subject to a little bit of tax. And we've made these huge promises to seniors we have no way of paying for, and now we're saying that almost all seniors won't have to pay any income tax either. We might decide that's a bad idea 5 or 10 years down the road. And if we've set this precedent that almost all seniors don't pay tax, it would be very hard to reverse that.
Do you think that either McCain or Obama has said anything really meaningful about how to address the huge national debt that we have, the debt that has just been accumulating and accumulating since the start of the war in Iraq?
Not since they've been running for president. Senator McCain, at times in the past, has been very responsible. He was a deficit hawk. He voted against President Bush's tax cuts, the things he would now make permanent. There's a problem during a campaign. There's a lot of pressure on the candidates to just make people happy, which is proposing tax cuts and proposing new spending programs to do stuff for people. And recognizing fiscal reality apparently is been determined to be a losing strategy for somebody who wants to be president. I don't quite understand that. I would like to have a president who would respect the public's intelligence and say, we can't do everything. We can't cut taxes and increase spending. And if I'm going to tell you that, well, I'm going to pass huge tax cuts, but I'm going to pay for it by cutting spending, I'm going to be very specific about what I'm going to cut and how I'm going to make that happen and how I will be successful when every president before me has talked about making the government more efficient, getting rid of agriculture subsidies, and has had a really hard time of getting those things through Congress. I mean, I have no doubt that McCain would like to cut spending a lot, but he has to deal with Congress. And, I think it would be a good idea to get rid of all the agriculture subsidies. But the Senate is a huge constituency for those, and it's probably implausible that you'll eliminate them. He said that he wants to hold discretionary spending fixed, below the levels where it is right now in real terms. Well, what that means is that it wouldn't even keep up with inflation. And that means that a lot of things that people have come to rely on from government won't happen anymore. Maybe it's a good idea to get rid of those things, but he ought to actually raise some specifics and say how he's going to do that. Senator Obama, on the other hand, has talked about all these new spending programs he'd like to put in place. He wants to spend on education, on infrastructure, and on health care. And his campaign says that, well, they're going to cut spending too. They want to make the government more efficient. They're going to save $50 billion by making the health care system work more. It sounds kind of optimistic to me. And, you can't be simultaneously increasing spending and cutting taxes and expect to be able to keep the deficit under control. And It is a concern. And I think actually fiscal prudence ought to be a bipartisan issue. Republicans and Democrats both have children. And the policies over the last 10 years, the policies that both of these candidates are proposing would just saddle our children with thousands and thousands of dollars of additional debt that they have to pay back. And I don't think Republicans or Democrats should be happy about that.
Well, Leonard Berman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Leonard Berman is the director of the Tax Policy Center, a joint project of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. Earlier in the show, we heard from the top economic advisors to the Obama and McCain campaigns. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.